but the end of the story thus far is a very complete triumph of the British private property owner over the dreams and schemes of Machiavellian absolutism. With the Hanoverian dynasty, England became, as the Times recently styled her, a crowned republic. She had worked out a new method of government, parliamentary government, recalling in many ways the Senate and popular assembly of Rome, but more steadfast and efficient because of its use, however restricted, of the representative method. Her assembly at Westminster was to become the mother of parliaments throughout the world. Towards the crown, the English Parliament was held, and still holds, much the relation of the mayor of the palace to the Merovingian kings. The king is conceived of as ceremonial and irresponsible, a living symbol of the royal and imperial system. But much power remains latent in the tradition and prestige of the crown, and the succession of the four Hanoverian Georges, William IV, 1830, Victoria, 1837, Edward VII in 1901, and the present King, George V, in 1910, is of a quite different strain from the feeble and short-lived Merovingian monarchs. In the affairs of the Church, the military and naval organizations, and the Foreign Office, these sovereigns have all, in various degrees, exercised an influence which is none the less important because it is indefinable. Fourth. Upon no part of Europe did the collapse of the idea of a unified Christendom bring more disastrous consequences than in Germany. Naturally, one would have supposed that the emperor, being by origin a German, both in the case of the earlier lines and in the case of the Habsburgs, would have developed into the national monarch of a united German-speaking state. It was the accidental misfortune of Germany that her emperors never remained German. Frederick II, the last Hohenstaufen, was, as we've seen, a half-orientalized Sicilian. The Habsburgs, by marriage and inclination, became, in the person of Charles V, first Burgundian and then Spanish in spirit. After the death of Charles V, his brother Ferdinand took Austria and the Empire, and his son Philip II took Spain, the Netherlands, and South Italy. But the Austrian line, obstinately Catholic, holding its patrimony mostly on the eastern frontiers, deeply entangled, therefore, with Hungarian affairs, and paying tribute, as Ferdinand and his two successors did, to the Turk, retained no grip upon the North Germans with their disposition towards Protestantism, their Baltic and westward affinities, and their ignorance of, or indifference to, the Turkish danger. The sovereign princes, dukes, electors, prince-bishops, and the like, whose domains cut up the map of the Germany of the Middle Ages into a crazy patchwork, were really not the equivalents of the kings of England and France. They were rather on the level of the great landowning dukes and peers of France and England. Until 1701, none of them had the title of king. Many of their dominions were less, both in size and value, than the larger estates of the British nobility. The German Diet was like the States General, or like a parliament without the presence of elected representatives, so that the great civil war in Germany that presently broke out, the 30 Years' War from 1618 to 1648, was, in its essential nature, much more closely akin to the civil war in England, 1643 to 49, and to the War of the Fronde, 1648 to 1653, the League of feudal nobles against the crown in France, then appears upon the surface. In all these cases the crown was either Catholic or disposed to become Catholic, and the recalcitrant nobles found their individualistic disposition tending to a Protestant formula. But while in England and Holland the Protestant nobles and rich merchants ultimately triumphed, and in France the success of the crown was even more complete, in Germany, neither was the emperor strong enough, nor had the Protestant princes a sufficient unity and organization among themselves to secure a conclusive triumph. It ended there in a torn-up Germany. Moreover, the German issue was complicated by the fact that various non-German peoples, the Bohemians and the Swedes, who had a new Protestant monarchy which had arisen under Gustav Vasa, as a direct result of the Reformation, were entangled in the struggle. Finally, the French monarchy, triumphant now over its own nobles, although it was Catholic, came in on the Protestant side with the evident intention of taking the place of the Habsburgs as the imperial line. The prolongation of the war, and the fact that it wasn't fought along a determinant frontier, but all over an empire of patches, Protestant here, Catholic there, made it one of the most cruel and destructive that Europe had known since the days of the barbarian raids. Its peculiar mischief lay not in the fighting, but in the concomitants of the fighting. It came at a time when military tactics had developed to a point that rendered ordinary levies useless against trained professional infantry. Volley firing with muskets at a range of a few score yards had abolished the individualistic knight in armour, but the charge of disciplined masses of cavalry could still disperse any infantry that hadn't been drilled into a mechanical rigidity. The infantry, with their muzzle-loading muskets, couldn't keep up a steady enough fire to wither determined cavalry before it charged home. They had, therefore, to meet the shock standing or kneeling behind a bristling wall of pikes or bayonets. For this they needed great discipline and experience. Iron cannon were still of small size and not very abundant, and they didn't play a decisive part as yet in warfare. They could plough lanes in infantry, but they couldn't easily smash and scatter it if it were sturdy and well-drilled. War under these conditions was entirely in the hands of seasoned professional soldiers, and the question of their pay was as important a one to the generals of that time as the question of food or munitions. As the long struggle dragged on from phase to phase, and the financial distress of the land increased, the commanders of both sides were forced to fall back upon the looting of towns and villages, both for supply and to make up the arrears of their soldiers' pay. The soldiers became, therefore, more and more mere brigands living on the country, and the 30 Years' War set up a tradition of looting as a legitimate operation in warfare and of outrage as a soldier's privilege that has tainted the good name of Germany right down to the Great War of 1914. The earlier chapters of Defoe's Memoirs of a Cavalier, with its vivid description of the massacre and burning of Magdeburg, will give the reader a far better idea of the warfare of this time than any formal history. So harried was the land that the farmers ceased from cultivation, what snatched crops could be harvested were hidden away, and great crowds of starving women and children became camp followers of the armies and supplied a thievish tale to the rougher plundering. At the close of the struggle, all Germany was ruined and desolate. Central Europe didn't fully recover from these robberies and devastations for a century. Here we can but name Tilly and Wallenstein, the great plunder captains on the Habsburg side, and Gustavus Adolphus, the King of Sweden, the Lion of the North, the champion of the Protestants, whose dream was to make the Baltic Sea a Swedish lake. Gustavus Adolphus was killed in his decisive victory over Wallenstein at Lützen in 1632, and Wallenstein was murdered in 1634. In 1648, the princes and diplomatists gathered amidst the havoc they had made to patch up the affairs of Central Europe at the Peace of Westphalia. By that peace, the power of the emperor was reduced to a shadow, and the acquisition of Alsace brought France up to the Rhine. And one German prince, the Hohenzollern Elector of Brandenburg, acquired so much territory as to become the greatest German power next to the emperor, a power that presently, in 1701, became the Kingdom of Prussia. The treaty also recognized two long-accomplished facts, the separation from the empire and the complete independence of both Holland and Switzerland. Fifth, we've opened this chapter with the stories of two countries, the Netherlands and Britain, in which the resistance of the private citizen to this new type of monarchy, the Machiavellian monarchy that was arising out of the moral collapse of Christendom, succeeded. But in France, Russia, in many parts of Germany and of Italy, Saxony and Tuscany, for example, personal monarchy wasn't so restrained and overthrown. It established itself indeed as the ruling European system during the 17th and 18th centuries.